We still do 7 NUFC Matters show a week for free. But if you want to help support NUFC Matters, then there are a few ways of doing it. Hit the like button on each live broadcast and video. This helps the channel grow. Hit the subscribe button and select the all notifications bell so you don't miss a single show. If you want to help us financially, then you can join the channel using this button with the membership starting at $1.99 a month. Or you can drop us a donation in the chat using a super sticker. We're also looking for sponsors. If you'd like your brand advertised on the flyers for the show and featured during the ad break, then email John at nufcmatters.com to arrange today.
Mr. Stephen Sayers, I'm arresting you on suspicion of armed robbery. You do not have to say anything. But anything you do say may be used in evidence against you.
I shall be moving on soon, so I want to ask you a favour.
Name it.
Don't make the same mistake that me and my brothers have done. Try. They'll throw away the key.
Hi, welcome along to NUFC Matters with me, Steve Rafe. Got a special interview today. As often we do, we go off on a tangent and speak to somebody who is not from the world of football, and delighted to welcome Jason Wilson, who is the author of this wonderful book, The Old Man and Me, A Gangster's Life, A Son's Journey. Hi, Jason. How are you doing?
Doing good. How are you doing, Steve?
Very good, mate. Very good. And I often start these interviews by asking the guest, do they have any football teams that they support? So, Jason, are you a football fan?
Yeah, Coventry was my team.
Oh, Coventry. We do have people in common. Darren Huckabee, Mickey Quinn.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they're pretty good nowadays. So, and I've been up a few times, the Birmingham and Stoke and that sort of thing. But, yeah, it's doing well now. Good days. Almost made it this season.
Yeah, good stuff. Brian Kilcline as well, another one. The guy who lifted the FA Cup, of course, for Coventry and helped Newcastle stay out of the third division and then get into the Premier League. So another big name player who is linked between us. But we're not here to talk football today. We're here to talk about your book. And it's a fascinating book and very kind of you to send us a copy. And it's one of those books which you can't put down. Once you do manage to pick it up, you can't put it down. And just reading the little biog on Amazon, which I'll stick the link below, will give you a taste of what this book's about. So if you like crime books, this is definitely for you. It's not like the old, Essex Boys stuff and the craze stuff, which, let's face it, have been done to death. If you want a different story, this is it. So delighted to have Jason on the show to give us an insight into it. And Jason, just give us a little bit of a background on you first before we get into the book. Just give us a little bit of background about your upbringing. Where were you brought up?
Okay, I was brought up in Coventry. Pretty working class. The only difference was my dad always worked for himself. He always had shops and he always had people working for him. And that was always the same. I'd never known him have a normal job. And so when we were kids, it was regular family. Used to go to work with my dad on Saturdays. He had furniture shops back then. And he was just a kind of a sort of father you idolise, I suppose. He was a tall guy, handsome guy. Social skills. He got on well with people really well. And I was never in the room where he wasn't like the top dog. He was always the one people deferred to. And it'd be years before I really knew what that was about. And then we get to about, I'm about six or seven, and then he goes away for a couple of years. And we go visit him at prison, but we don't know it's a prison. I believe it's a college. He comes out after that. But while he was away, he talked about these businesses he was going to do, cooker shops and that sort of thing. And for the next few years, that's what he does. And this, in my eyes, he's just a regular business guy. He has dozens of people working for him. He has all these shops and warehouses. So, like I said, to me, this is all kind of normal. And I accept he's a little bit above the regular fathers in the sense that he always has a lot of money. He always has plenty of cars. And like I said, he always has these workers in places. And, you know, like I said, you never see anyone tell him what to do. And all his mates are like that as well. When you go out with him on calls and meetings on a Saturday night, he'd go from like shop to shop and house to house, and they'd just have these meetings. But they wouldn't be about cookers, about other stuff. And he'd speak, you know, maybe they'd go in the garden and have a quiet chat or whatever, go out of earshot. But it was all quite regular. And he'd go and meet people on car parks. That was quite regular. And then some of the characters were, I suppose they were crime figures, but they also had fronts there. They were business people. And I think that's the way he saw them. And that's the way I saw them. They were just business guys who later on you realize, well, they're the Bowmans and they were his mates and whatever. And yeah, you hear these little family names around Cov and you realize they were just mates of his who he did business with and whose houses he used to go around with as a kid. And you go and play in the backyard where he spoke to the dad. So it was all kind of fairly normal stuff until I get to about 10, 11. And then you come back from school one day and you're told to sit in the back room and then they tell you he's been caught robbing a bank. And a few months later, he gets 10 years. And then after that, you start to reprocess everything and you start to hear things and start recognising who these people are he has working for him. And then one thing you notice is he has these shops, these furniture shops, and they're called Lloyd's and Westminster's, and he's named them all after banks. The rumour always was they were banks he robbed when he was younger. And there were little things like that. And the name Spencer, he was originally called Tony Shipley, and he changed his name to Tony Spencer. And you find out the first robbery he did was the Spencer Social Club when he was a 17-year-old lad, and he got caught for that, and he went to Borstal. And that seems to be where he got his name from. So there's all these little hints he used to have fun with.
I found it quite fascinating. As you set the scene, really, that how good a businessman he actually was. And when he left school, you know, I think in the book it talks about him being a bike mechanic in Earlsdon. As you say, running furniture shops. He set up a national mainland gas company. In Gosford Street?
It was like I said, when I was a kid, he was kind of the biggest name for a while because he had all these shops on Gosford Street. That's where a lot of the villains operated. Mm-hmm. And he was the biggest figure on that sort of area. And some people were like, he'd kind of got a bit too big because he was still dabbling in villainy, I'd later realise. And he was involved in all sorts and he antagonised the police a lot over the years. But a lot of these things would only come out years later when I was a teenager.
Mm. Fascinating. I mean, they often say the criminal minds, if they were put to good use, you know, could be very successful businessmen. You hear that a lot, don't you, Jason?
He did. It was like that with him, but there was always something a little bit missing. He loved setting things up and starting things. But once things were ticking over, he kind of got bored. So he was always on to the next thing and the next thing. And I think he liked that excitement every day and that buzz. And later on, when I go and work for him, you realise it's kind of part of his makeup. To have a day where everything goes normally or is just wasn't really his sort of thing. He always had to have some sort of thing he was up to, some sort of scam or just something that made life more interesting. And he was always like that. And he wasn't like a businessman or later on a criminal where he would have one thing. He would always have four or five things and he would dot from one to the other, which means I suppose you've got more exposure, but life's more exciting, more daring, I guess.
Yeah, no, definitely. So, I mean, in those early days, you didn't realise you were going to prison, but obviously this big sentence that comes along when you're 11.
This is a long line in Worcester.
You
go there and it's the real thing.
And that split the family up.
Yeah, it's pretty common. You see people get 10 years and they think, oh, well, I'm going to do 10 years, but the family's got to do the 10 years as well. And at the start, I'm about 11 years old and I'm confident we can do that. And I don't really appreciate everything else that's going on around you. You know, like your mom and dad and your older brother is at school and you just don't really get that. And the odds are for us, we were never really going to make it. So after I get to about 13, 14, my brother's no longer visiting, nor is my sister. I mean, mom's reluctant. And then with a short time, they get divorced. And if you go on a visit, you've got to go on your own. So our relationship also starts to break down for a while. And then it resurfaces. We do 6.5 of 10 years, and then he comes out. He's just a little bit grayer, but he's pretty much the same. He's got that same dominant manner, and he's got a head full of ideas. And this is when he gets involved in counterfeiting American dollars, when he's pursued by the Sirius Regional Crime Squad. From the day he comes out, they're on him. And for 6 months, he's got surveillance on him. Even when I go out with him I'm a 17-year-old student at the time. And I go out with him driving. He's got cars following him and stuff. And it's kind of quite normal for him by that point. And he realises he's become very accustomed to all this crime stuff. And I later realise he's done all sorts when he's been in prison as well. Because a lot of people think when you're in prison, you just vegetate. Whereas when you're there, you're actually doing stuff. You're kind of training, you're making contacts, and you kind of do little things in prison to kind of make life a bit more meaningful and to earn a bit of money, I suppose. So he comes out and he does this counterfeit. I think it's about 89. Within 6 months, he gets raided, goes on the run. There's a large trial. It goes on about 5 months. And in the end, he gets a guilty. He gets 11 years. So that's kind of pretty heavy. And by that point, I'm about 19 by that point. So it's kind of he's gone again for another 7 years. And you're kind of left on your own to actually, I suppose, just go off in your own direction. My mum's view always was it's kind of a good thing he was away because he was a bad influence. Because it would have been the case, I would have worked for him, my brother and my sister, we would have all worked for him. Because he goes away for 7 years. I do other stuff, but when he does come out, that's exactly what happened. My sister goes to work for him first, my brother follows, and so do I. And we end up with this little family business in the mid-90s, which is kind of running cannabis and amphetamine, which is kind of the main thing he comes out to do next.
I mean, how did you get involved in that? I mean, you know, by that time, you know, he's got a hefty sentence.
Yeah.
As you say, you're 19, you've got your own life. I mean, what were you doing and what did you give up to go and work in this family business?
Well, I'd always had this curiosity because he'd always, at 15 years, he did 13 years inside. And you see this a bit of this world inside, but you kind of, you know, you think, well, what would have happened if he'd never gone away? You know, we would have had these businesses and we would have all been working as a family. And that's one of the key things, you kind of miss family. Because when he goes away, you're all kind of fragmented doing your own thing. And when he come out when I was like 24, 25, he was kind of a unifying figure. He said he was doing cigarettes and he was like, you know, I was kind of a bit down on my luck by that point. I've done well for a while and then start to plummet. And he was like, well, why don't you just come and do a bit of driving work, earn a bit of money, doing all these cigarettes. You know, your sister's driving, your brother's driving. He had all these other people. And I thought, oh, why not? I've always wanted to work with him and get to know him as an adult. And that's exactly what I do. I go work for him and I start off doing driving without going too much into the details of what exactly you do. But things like paperwork and drop-offs and pickups and all that sort of thing, you start doing that and you start to understand what his world is really about and why he does get such a buzz out of working around these people and doing these things and kind of putting everything on the line, at least say once a day or majorly once a week, whenever you're doing something like a mix or a big drop off or whatever.
Did you get the same kind of excitement?
Slightly different. It was answering a lot of questions, really. When you do get a bit of a buzz at the time, I mean, you kind of go out and you see more money in an afternoon than you'll see all year. You think, and it's very casual. I think the first pickup I did, I picked up about 40 grand from Brighton, which don't sound a lot now, it was a lot more then, but you kind of get it. And I phoned him up. I thought, oh, God, he picked up his 40 grand. You phone him up and he's like, well, I'm a bit busy. Can you drop it off later? He's kind of so casual about it. And when they drop it off, he doesn't even count it. He's like, can you just count it for me? I've got calls to do. And it's just such a minor thing. And you start to realise how his world's very different to what I kind of know. And then I relate it to when I was little and all this money I used to see when I was a kid and how casual he was then. All these employees he's had. And he's kind of, the makeup hasn't really changed. He kind of is, it's gone from something very legitimate and now he's doing it with crime. And there's a parallel between, you know, when you deal with cookers and you're buying something, you're selling it. And it's the same with drugs. You just, you know, buy low, sell high. And it's pretty much the same thing. You're shifting things, a lot of secrecy. But it's the same business structure he uses virtually, but there's a lot of secrecy as always. But I do get to understand him better. And I end up driving for him, you know, like when I'm actually, because when he's working in the day, he doesn't drive himself. He's always got a driver. And if you're going to have a driver, you've got to have someone you can trust 100%. And you can't trust anyone more than family. So that's what I do. I go driving him every day, pick him up wherever he's ended up the night before, because he wouldn't stay in the same place more than a few days running. So, you know, say, where are you? I'm at such and such. I'll give you the nickname. You go out, meet him. And then all day you're with him and you're going from meeting to meeting to meeting all around the country. And some of the meetings I'll sit on because they say, you know, you're Tony's son. Just sit there. Just carry on with chatting. And the odd person would be like, no, it's just me and Tony. And they go over there and you just, you know, have a cup of tea and just sit on by. But you do get to learn the business he's doing and how it kind of works. And I suppose the thrill and the buzz he gets from it. Because it's an obsession with him. And it's like that with all his, you know, his peers. He sees all these other guys. And it's all their obsession. That's why they do when they wake up in the morning. It's kind of, they've a lot on and they're almost just like business people really, except they've got the incentives of a lot of money to kind of work hard. But he's probably more obsessed than most of them. It's kind of his big thing. And you can only ever think on scale as well. A lot of the guys would be a case of they'd have their deals and they'd watch their deals. But his was he'd have four or five deals. So he'd have multiple transports going. He'd do a few lines. You know, it's like I could do the amphetamine, I'd do the cannabis, maybe even do cigarettes because that was a good earner at the time. But he doesn't really sit still on one thing. So he deals with a lot of people. And that was a bit different to most of them. I think he was quite fearless and a bit risk averse. So he got a buzz from it. I suppose it comes down to that, really.
I mean, as an international drug smuggler who was importing hash and amphetamines, he was quite clean living, wasn't he?
Yeah, and that's for some things. I mean, you have all these cliches, but if you met him, you'd never guess he was a criminal. One thing, he couldn't stand smoking. It was like you couldn't smoke in any of the cars. He was, if you were driving, you couldn't. No one could smoke in the cars. And he was very anti little things like that. And having tattoos, it's something that we were kind of brought up with. But it was also a criminal thing as well. He couldn't really understand why criminals got tattoos for. And a lot of the old people were like that. It's kind of because you got, you know, CCTV, you're kind of just showing yourself and things like that. And distinctive haircuts and all this sort of thing and brand clothing and modifying your car and that sort of thing. To him, everything had to blend in. You had to disappear. And one thing you were polite and you got on with people because you didn't want to stand out. And that was like that wherever he went. And a lot of people, even to this day, will say to me, they say, you know, Tony, he wasn't a criminal, but he dealt drugs. Okay, so he was a criminal, but not like a real hard, you know, violent criminal. But then they could say, well, he shot somebody. And there was it's kind of a bit like that, just because he doesn't look the part. You know, when you see the films, some of them look like criminals. But the whole point is you're not really supposed to look like a criminal. You know, you're supposed to blend in, almost disappear and really fool people into thinking you're something you're not. And that's something he did, but he liked people around him like that who didn't stand out. And that was the same with everything. Everyone who worked for him, all his drivers, it was about blending in. If you had someone coming up with a loud car or they were loud in their personal manner, it just slowly stopped giving them work because they're going to draw attention. And that's, like I said, you've got to get on with people and you've got to blend in. And that's kind of the name of the game when it comes to dropping things off, picking things up and all that sort of thing. And also you're dealing with a lot of international people. It's some of the guys would see, you see on the estates and you could tell they hardly left the estate. But it's like our lot, you'd see the people in Holland or Spain, you were dealing with, you know, people from different cultures. So that's another reason you had to kind of get on with these people as well. But he was able to do that very easily. And I think maybe that was being in prison. He kind of mixed with a lot of different groups. Like he mixed a lot with the Irish and he mixed people in the Midlands, but all over the country. And a lot of the Midlands people, a lot of them would stick to their own. And he was never really like that. He always mixed and he was like a gregarious sort of guy. And when he went to prison, that's most of the thing he did was kind of networked really. And he'd get shipped out, network again, and apply for education, get shipped out again, and just accumulate all these contacts.
He dealt in Class B and Class C, but he was quite adamant that he wouldn't deal in Class A's.
Yeah. I mean, when he first came out, he put forward a practical explanation for that. And he was like, I mean, he'd learned it when he was inside. When you look at all the paperwork from all the cases, for Cat A, the police resources were massive, but the ones for B and C were a lot lower. So he figured the one product to go with was amphetamine at this time, because it was, some people thought it was Class A, it was Class B, and the profit was really good on it. And there was, people couldn't mix it very well. That was another issue. So he went over to Holland and he got a chemist there, and the chemist took him through it. And they did he did the first few mixes in Holland so he could, you know, get the process correct. So he could take the base and kind of double it or put it back to base and things like that. So he got very comfortable with that. And that would be the line he would specialize in the Midlands. He would start bringing in like mass amounts of amphetamine. But the risk was lower. I think the maximum you're looking at 14 if you went not guilty, and it was a long trial and everything, and you got caught red-handed. But really, he said if you ever get caught, he's looking at like an 8, the way he saw it. So he'd made that calculation on that. And a lot of the guys he worked with who did Class A's, they ended up getting 20s in years to come. But he would get the low sentences, like he said, or he'd avoid them altogether and they'd get dropped.
Yeah, interesting stuff. He ended up in court again, didn't he? He had a trial in Birmingham. He was found not guilty. But then,
yeah, that's it.
He had the second one, didn't he, Lumen? But then he absconded to Amsterdam.
Yeah, I mean, the first one, that was a big trial, that one, the first one. And he was predicted to get, I think they were offering him a 12. They were so convinced they'd got him. But the trial, we got a new jury, and the jury was excellent, the second jury. So we ran with it. They put his previous in. We ran with that as well. The jury seemed to like he had previous, but at the same time, he sold himself as a cigarette dealer. Well, when they did all these calls, all they ever talked about was cigarettes. So the original crime squad, they had 300 hours of bug tapes, and all they ever heard him talk about was cigarettes. It was always Embassies and Super Kings. Embassies was cannabis. Super Kings was amphetamine. And that's all they talked about. And all the guys he dealt with, they all used the same code. So when he went in front of the jury, he was like, well, I'm a cigarette dealer. All the evidence says I'm a cigarette dealer. And it really was down to them to prove he was doing anything else. And, you know, come to it, they just couldn't manage it. And there were cigarettes all around. That's another thing. Wherever he went, he always made sure there were cigarettes. So if he ever got raided, they'd say, well, we found cigarettes. He's talking about cigarettes. And he's claiming he's a cigarette dealer. And it was kind of, you know, balls in your court. So he had one trial, got found not guilty, was out for 6 months, another set of raids, he has to go on the run, and he ends up in Amsterdam. But from Amsterdam, he just focuses on the smuggling, the actual exporting it over to the UK.
And Amsterdam is where, you know, he had a brush with death. Tell us about that, Jason.
Yeah, this was about 2000, I think it was. Is what it was. It was started up over some money. There was some money being, you know, the money gets put in a lorry, gets taken up to Amsterdam. Except the group it was coming off were a bit nervy about it, and they wanted a guy to go with it with the money. Initially, I was up for it, and at the 11th hours, I got pulled out, and an Irish guy went along, one of their people. And as it turned out, he got robbed. There's about something like 220 grand robbed at gunpoint. And within a few days, you figure out where the leak is. And you think, well, it's got to come from there. And it takes you back to the people. It's got to be them. So they did a bit of tracking, found out what part of the city. They're from Bradford. Found a watch, bit of Bradford, found the street, found the family, sent someone around, took a note. So basically, you've got to ring this guy in Holland. You've got our money. The guy phoned. Initially, denied it. But once it was put to him in, you know, more straight terms, he admitted, I've got it. So what are you going to do? And he just says, well, you need to do a bit of research and I'll speak to you in a few days. And that's what he did. They started talking again. The guy agreed to hand the money back, but he was very reticent about it. And it would string him along for a few weeks. So you did figure something was going on here. And in the end, he turned around and said, OK, I'm going to give you back. I've spent 30. I'll give you 190 back. And my dad said, that's fine. They met in Amsterdam one night. Sort of a sip of water. They met in Amsterdam one evening, and the idea was the guy was just going to give him the money back. But when he gets to the car, he hasn't got the money. He's like, my guy's got it. You know, he's offside. We'll drive down, see him. He's got your money. And my dad it hasn't felt right, and he's got a small pistol on him. The guy drives him down to the docks on in Iplane on North Amsterdam. It's kind of quiet around there. So he drives him down to the docks where his man's there, and he's not there. It's just darkness, and it's a good place for an ambush. Sure enough, that's what's happened. He gets a knock at the door, yanks open. There's a guy there, like a ski mask and a gun in his face, and just tells him to get out of the car. And there's another guy behind him, also with a ski mask and gun, and he's kind of got to figure out what he's going to do. As he tells the story later, his thinking is, if he gets out of the car, they're going to kill him. So he has to stay at the car, because as they've been driving, he smelt the car, and he detects it's a rental. It's, you know, it's beautifully valeted. The guy doesn't know whether, you know, the to do your wipers. He's not familiar with the car at all. So he figures they've hired a car just for tonight for this thing. So he's got to stay at the car, because they're not going to shoot him in the car. The things like forensics and stuff, they're going to have to get him out. So reluctantly, he starts to get out the car, but he's not leaving. And as he climbs up, he pulls the pistol from his inside pocket and starts shooting. But just as he does that, one of them panics, shoots him at point blank range. He gets a blow to the chest. Doesn't go down. He kind of recoils. And then he just fires. One guy goes down. And then the guy who's stole the money, who was driving him that night, he steps out. He's unarmed. And my dad just shoots him in the chest and he's dead. But he's got this blow to the chest himself. And so he's just got to coordinate, find out where he is, and he just gets away. Gets to a safe house. The Dutch kind of move him to his own place. And once he's there, he phones me and tells me to get over there as quickly as he can. He says, you know, I've had an accident. On that ferry, you can see a little scar on his chest. That's where the bullet went in. So I head over, thinking he's had some sort of problem, maybe been attacked or something. Obviously, it turns out he's been shot and he's in the safe house. All the phones are off. He's got one worker there. And we stay there for a couple of days and wait and see if he's going to pull through or not, because he's in a really bad way. He's on all these medications and everything. And that's all we do. We just stay in this house for 2 days, seeing if he's going to pull through. He's on the stretcher bed in the living room. Lights are out. Phones are off. Well, they're not there, actually. But it's a case of he just stops taking his meds. He tells us what's happened in detail. And he tells us this long story, which I put in the first chapter of the book. But then gradually he starts to pull through. I think it's by the second day he's kind of starting to sit up. And immediately he wants some fresh phones on. He wants to let people know he's okay and that, because there's been phone calls to people we've heard about. But like I said, we haven't really got great contact with anybody. But he says people have to start seeing me. But he doesn't trust a lot of the British guys. He wants just the Dutch people. He trusts the Dutch people. So the Dutch start visiting him. They start wrapping up business. Still on the stretcher bed. He's still recovering, but he talks a hell of a lot. But they start to wrap all these deals up, because he's going to have to get out of Holland, because there's all police down at the docks and they've been to the bar and that, where they think he might have been taken. And that's how I left him in the end. A few days later, he's kind of standing. He's got a walking stick and whatever. But, you know, he's going to be okay. And he's going to be in Holland, in Spain, a few days later. And so that's what happened. He heads down to Barcelona and just starts up again. But meanwhile, this murder investigation in Holland will just rumble on and it won't really go away. During the shooting, he kind of leant on the bonnet of the car and he leaves a nice palm print there. And from that and a bit of DNA, they kind of eventually figure out it's him. They know he's been shot during the shooting, but it's just years before they know where he's been shot. So as it turns out, he's been shot in the chest, and it's a dum-dum bullet, you know, so the bullet sprays. Yeah. So he's got this evidence of the shooting inside him. So years later, when he does go on trial, that's his evidence inside him. And when they do the scan, it kind of helps clear him. But at the same time, he goes for a few years with this bullet inside him, which is kind of really bad news. Because every couple of months, it'll inflame up, he'll get infections. And then he has to take loads of, you know, penicillin and everything, get rid of it, carry on as normal. Then it comes back again. It just doesn't go away. So it's a real bad thing, this bullet wound is, because it's, like I said, it's just all these fragments. Some of them worked their way through and some of them just stayed in there. Yeah, just one of those things.
So obviously, you know, he's had that brush with death. He does go to Spain, carries on in the same business, but he eventually comes back to England in 2007. And he's still involved with illegal importation then. And eventually his luck runs out.
Yeah, this is when they launch Operation Downpour. Yeah, it comes back in 2007. They kind of meet him at the airport. He's got police surveillance on the first day. He's there. He comes to stay at my house. We go down the high street the next day, and you've got, they're undercover officers there, but I think that it might be they were wanting to be seen just to let him know they were there, because he spots them pretty much straight away. We're kind of on the high street, and he just tells me, just look up the road. There's a guy there just lingering. And you kind of watch him. He's lingering for nothing. He's not a local or anything. And as you walk up, he kind of gives him a nod, and the guy kind of in the end just shrugs. And then there's another surveillance up there as well. But as soon as he's back, they're letting him know they're there. But maybe they just know his nature, because he's going to go back to what he was doing. Except he's got a fresh slate now. The investigation from years ago has been dropped into the amphetamine. So that's gone. He'd gone to trial in Holland. He'd been found not guilty. So that's kind of gone. And he'd done his sentence in Spain. So fresh slate as far as he's concerned. But times have changed a little bit. The cannabis, there isn't the money in the cannabis there once was. The amphetamine is still a good line. And I suppose cocaine is the one that is the appealing one. But he's going to stick with amphetamine, as it turns out. And he starts to reestablish things with Holland. But this time they've kind of upped their game. You know, the police, they've had two main shots at him. The first one not guilty, the second one they dropped. And the third time they kind of really ramp it up. So this time they're going to use intercepts as well as anything. But also the intercepts go across into Holland as well, in Belgium and France. So they're kind of following him wherever he goes in Europe, which is a real game changer. Before you could lose them at borders, and you can't now. So they've got this big operation on them. There's about 10 of them, all in different, there's about three cities. There's 10 of them, and he's kind of heading the group, bringing amphetamine over. And then one day he's at a farmhouse on the edge of Amsterdam. And there's I think there's telecom engineers there. And he susses, they seem like the surveillance, so they might have a problem. They start getting rid and kind of cleaning up and everything. And within, you know, it's about 10 minutes, there's a bulldozer come through the gates and there's police everywhere. And so it's kind of the same thing all over again. It gets held in Holland for about a year. Eventually they extradite him, and then they get set for this big trial at Birmingham, which again, it's going to be like 10 people charged on this one. So it's going to be a very big trial. But there's a lot of complications with these phone intercepts to do with, you know, things like phone hacking and a thing called a roving bug. Was back then, I'd gone over to Holland and saw this. When you used to sit down with the Dutch, they all started removing the batteries on their phones, because it said the Dutch could activate the phone and use it as a recording device. And that was quite standard. So the last time I went to Holland with them, that's what everyone was doing. It turns out that's what they were doing on the intercepts. They were passing off conversation with a roving bug and claiming they were intercepts. So you'd be sitting there having your coffee, and all of a sudden the phone hadn't gone, but there'd be a recording of a conversation. And they were trying to put them in as evidence. So there's a bit of a standoff on this. So in the end, when it come to the court, on the day of court, all the barristers sat down and they negotiated. Nick Davies from The Guardian was scheduled to come up and kind of cover the event, because we thought, if we can get it in the national papers, it'll kind of threaten all the cases they've had on intercepts. But in the end, they did a deal, which was in line with Dutch sentencing rather than British. And he got 5 years, and which meant all the others, because he's the head guy, they were getting fours and threes. So it turned out to be a good deal from the outsider's point of view. So 5 years on that. And so he just settled down to do his sentence. I think he would have gone back to it after if he'd had the chance. But while he was inside, he'd have some problems, you know, with his chest from years earlier.
And was that down to the bullet wound?
That's down to the, but never really gets, he's still got these fragments inside. And when he's inside, he goes for scans and he finds out that where the bullet's gone, he's all riddled with cancer. And they say, well, look, this is terminal. You can't, there's no way out on this. And initially they're telling me, you've probably only got weeks to live. So someone like finds out in the September and said, well, you'll be gone by Christmas. So he starts planning his funeral and that. He's got good barristers and they applied to get him out on compassionate leave. He's only done he's done a year in Holland on waiting for the trial, year in the UK. So after 2 years, he gets released on compassionate grounds. He has an operation, you know, just to kind of try and cut it out. Kind of spreading. But the operation goes well. Really knocks him about, but then he starts to recover and he starts to look quite well afterwards. And then he starts to import cannabis from Holland, which is a medicinal cannabis for his cancer. and that starts to reverse it. So for the next 4 years, he'll go on and he'll start going back to what he used to do, except it's a bit more, it's a bit quieter, I have to admit. It's a bit more, when he was younger, he used to do, you know, trading furniture. He starts to have a furniture business. He starts buying and selling. But then behind the scenes, he's dealing with this guy out in Venezuela and they're trying to import and all this sort of thing again. And he's kind of having these meetings on Skype. He never really loses that sort of, you know, that appetite. And then the final thing he does is in Spain, he applies for a medicinal cannabis license because he's got cancer and he gets granted it. And it's something he can duplicate around Spain. So he starts to organize this like cannabis growing in Spain where you use these cancer licenses to grow cannabis. And that was the last thing he was going to start importing cannabis oil to the UK. But then just as that was coming together, the cancer started to advance. And in the last couple of weeks, that's when he just couldn't shake it off. And then he passed away in 2015.
How old was he?
He was 66. Like, lived healthily, never smoked. It was just down to the bullet wound, I think. We're pretty certain that's what it was, because it was just all those years of, you know, infections. And he'd been told this when he was in Spain. He was treated by a doctor out there. He'd been out in some war, and he was familiar with gunshot wounds. And he said, you need to get it out, because that's what it'll do to you. You'd end up with it'll kill you from the inside with a cancer. But he was always on the run, so he was either on the run or he was inside, or things were going too fast for him to, you know, go to a hospital and actually get the stuff out. But
It's an amazing story. It's an amazing book. You know, that's how we met online. Just, you know, he sent me a copy, and it's a fascinating life story. Just go back to the funeral, I guess. Yeah. You know, what kind of turnout did he have? Because, you know, from my perspective, you know, you're reading the book, you would imagine it would be quite a good cross section of life, because most people who met him would see him as a charming, charismatic, you know, polite guy. Yeah. Couldn't believe that he was a criminal.
I mean, most people didn't actually know he'd passed till afterwards. It was kind of, he had a quiet funeral. It was only some of the COV people knew about it, and they came. And you had some people from the crime squad, you know, just taking notes at the back quietly,
making sure he passed over.
Yeah, there was that. So it's kind of a low key funeral. I mean, the church was full on that, but it wasn't like everybody knew about it.
Yeah,
that wasn't the case at all. A couple of weeks before he passed, he was actually still working. He had people from Amsterdam flying over, and this sort of, so he's, you know, he was connecting people up with contacts and things. So, and then all of a sudden, 2 weeks, he went downhill. The last 2 weeks passed. Then you got the funeral, and everyone was like, well, the last time I saw him, he was over in Holland, or he was in Spain. He used to travel to Ireland still. He eventually got his passport back, which Soccer didn't like, because the deal was, we released him in September, he's supposed to be dead by Christmas. And he just kept going and going for 4 years. That just wasn't supposed to have happened at all. But yeah, the funeral, it was a kind of a low key thing, but it was, you know, it was kind of all family and that. The family never really saw him as a criminal. You know, his sister especially, they always saw him as a businessman who actually got mixed up with the wrong people. That was always their thing. But to the people who knew him, he was just, you know, that's just the way he was. He kind of lived this life, and it kind of, it was a life he chose, and it was always, he never had any regrets. When he was inside, he never complained. Right at the end, he was just glad he'd done everything he wanted to do. So there was no, never heard him complain about stuff or where it was going. Even when he got shot, he never complained. It was just always, you know, he just kind of always rolled with things, no matter what the sentence or the cancer. He tended to take these things in his stride for some reason. Just, I suppose it was just his outlook on the world. He just saw these things happen.
And I mean, you yourself, I mean, your life, you know, you've been an animator, graphic novelist, you've got a psychology graduation, you're a care worker, you've lived an exciting life yourself. So why did you decide to sit and write the book, Jason?
Well, when I worked with him in the 90s, I thought this would be a great movie, but you couldn't really make it and you couldn't write about it because it's just, you just couldn't do that because there's too many people involved. But after he passed away, I did think about it. And I thought, well, a lot of these people are away now. It's always a possibility. But then I heard about, there's another journalist from up north of England who was writing a book. And he was interested in my dad and what he was about. But when he asked about him, he came up with a lot of crap about, you know, he did this. And, well, no, he didn't. And he didn't seem to be interested in doing the research on him correctly or understanding what he was about. And I thought, if you don't write something, this guy's going to write something. So it's kind of, he's going to write your father's history. So it's, so I did think, well, I've done animation, I've done graphic novels, I should be able to write a book. So I just sat down, started writing all this stuff that had been in my head for 25 years. All this stuff you don't really talk about. I know in films, everyone sits around, they talk about, you know, you don't really do that, even with my brother and that. You just didn't, once things had happened, you didn't talk about them. That's just the, you're always thinking bugs or intercepts or gossip or whatever. And our family was just that way. So I started writing it secretly. And when it got decent, I started showing people. And they said, yeah, it's going well. And then I just kind of pushed it to the finish line. But a lot of that has come from him really thinking, you always thought you could do anything you put your mind to. And I said, I did that when I was an animator and a graphic novel, and I thought I can do this. And the book came out really well. So I had to edit it right down, use a lot of aliases, keep the focus quite tight. There's some people I can't mention in the book, but I can use aliases. And I was taking a bit of a gamble in naming them because I thought they might get the ump afterwards. But as it turns out, I've spoke to them since and they were good with it. They thought my judgment was good. Because a lot of time's passed and some of them are out of the game. And one or two that are in the game, I didn't mention. They're under very good aliases, so they were okay with it. They were probably the people I was more concerned with. So the book's got this kind of narrow focus. But if you're familiar with organised crime, especially the centre section, you'll realise, well, this just shows you what it's really like. You know, it gets rid of all the, you know, the movie stuff you see. And this shows how you have to function, really, to sustain yourself and go from year to year. You do have to have that manner of blending in, especially internationally. You have to be able to do that. And it shows that world what it's really like. Especially, and it provides a bit of a case study of my dad showing, well, here's a criminal who isn't someone who, if you met him, you wouldn't think he was. He is that deceptive, but he's very dominant as well. There's a lot of contradictions with him. And a lot of criminals, I think, are like that. It's not just the stereotypes don't really work when you get up close. And that was the case with him. Like I said, even now, a lot of people just don't see him as a gangster or a criminal that way. They see him as a businessman who just happened to do crime because it's hard to think of him that way. But that's down to personality. And I suppose that's why he did so well at it.
What do you think he would have made of this this book about his life?
I think he would love the book because he loved this idea of, if you read the book, you see he's got this cat and mouse relationship with the police. Especially in the drug smuggling section when we're under surveillance. He liked the idea that they were after him and they couldn't get him. He always liked that, you know, like this battle of wits. So the idea that he can say, look, I did all this stuff and you can't touch me. He kind of liked that. And I think that's why he would like the book. We did some graphic novels years ago when he was in Spain and we worked on them together and he got a real kick out of that, you know, seeing these caricatures of him on the news or in a TV in a news article or something. He liked seeing that. He kind of got a bit of a buzz because in what he did, you couldn't really declare anything you ever did. It was always quiet. So for me to secretly do that, he liked that. So I think he'd certainly like the book and he'd like how the book's quite fearless as well. He always thought if you do something, you've got to do it correctly and you don't hold back. And I think on this book, I kept the focus, didn't go off to the left or right too much. But what I did write, I'll do it right. I'll do it fearlessly. And as some people say, you could say you put yourself in on lots of things, but I just figure, you've got to have a bit of truth in the book. This book's got to be how it was. And so I do endeavour to show that.
I've written numerous books over the years about notorious criminals and criminal families. And I always make a point, you know, especially if I'm doing an interview for the media, that, you know, that I don't condone anything that these people have ever done. What kind of message do you think your book, you know, portrays and what kind of message would you like it when you said what kind of message did you want this book to give to some influential youngster maybe who's sitting at home? You know, we've got a big problem in this country at the moment in the UK with county lines, for example. What kind of message did you want to send across with this book?
Well, I wanted to kind of break a lot of the myths around crime, for one thing. Something I learned from psychology, it's this way you learn to understand. If you're studying someone with a psychopathy, it's about understanding them. And I thought that's what I wanted to do with this. You actually write it so you can understand crime and understand the people who take part. Not to condone it or anything, but just so you kind of understand, so your knowledge is better. A lot of people think, well, I can just charge in and do this sort of thing. But once you're around these guys and you see what it's really like, you realise very few people are cut out for it. My dad's story is a fascinating story, but you wouldn't really want to copy it. You know, he spent almost 25 years inside, no regrets. Most people spent just a year inside but have regrets. It's you've got to be a different type. You've got to have a different type of mentality to think that way and do the things he did. Because, I mean, a lot of people, they go to inside and they don't go back because it's a bad experience. Whereas the Harden guys say, well, just, that's done, on to the next thing. And he was of that breed. And very few people are like that. My son-in-law, he's got a mate in prison at the minute. It was hard as nuts when he was out. He's in, and he's once he got in there, he's fucking, I ain't coming here again. He's just, he's not really cut out for it. And I don't think many people are. And I think it illustrates that there are people like that. And it's best you understand what they're really about rather than have a glamorized portrayal. So I don't think the book does that. One thing the book does do, which I wanted to do right from the start, I also wanted to show what affects a family. Because usually you have a book or a film and it'll show the head guy, you know, the criminal and all this stuff he does, but it doesn't show you what happens when he gets caught, you know, to the family. And I thought that's an important dimension to show. Like in my family, he just broke the family up. But that's quite common. I mean, most families don't go beyond a whole sentence. If the bloke gets 10 years, chances are his family won't be there when he comes out. And that's pretty much how it is. And a lot of the people who worked for him were like that. They'd come out in their 30s and 40s. They had old families and they were divorced and kids they never saw. And they had to start again from scratch. And the thing that offered them a great deal was crime. So they'd go back to it. But I think showing the reality of that is a real healthy thing. It's not something to be frightened of or just, you know. I think people in the media would like you just to kind of work, you know, play up to the stereotypes. I spoke to some journalists like that. They actually just want to hear about violence and what a nasty guy these criminals are. It's not really like that. A lot of the criminals are charming guys, and a lot of them are business-minded people, but they make their choices and they take the consequences with it. Yeah, and I don't think very few people would do that. So I think the book's kind of realistic. So I don't know what you thought on that. But I do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a really exciting book, and it takes you on the journey. I think it's unique as well. I mean, I put him alongside maybe Howard Marks. Howard Marks got a lot of publicity. He was in a similar kind of game. Probably got more notoriety purely because of his many identities. I knew Howard very well. I got to work with him and do a lot of stage shows with him, but also became a good friend. And fascinating stories. A lot of the stuff that Howard put in, his first book, Mr. Nice, became an international bestseller, but his subsequent books, not all the stories are in there because he didn't want to give some people away. But it's up there with that story, and it deserves to go that little bit further. I presume what you'd like to see now is somebody take it up and potentially do a script for it and make it into a film, Jason.
It would be good if that it went that way. I mean, I'm writing another book at the moment, which is a bit more focused on the 90s. And it's all the stuff I want. It's the book I wanted to write 20 years ago and thought I can't. But now I think I can. I've spoke to enough people. I think I'll go ahead with that. And hopefully that would sell the first book and maybe one of them will end up on the screen.
It takes time. I mean, it isn't an easy process. And I guess I don't know how you've coped, writing the second book, but I found writing my second book was really, really difficult. The first one, between the first one and the second one, there was a 6-7 year gap. Because I just got writer's block. You put a lot of time and effort into writing that first one, and then you almost become your biggest critic, Jason.
Yeah, I think I've had 6 months on the second book, and a lot of it was getting it. So it complements the first, but it's different. So you're kind of having to write in a slightly different style.
Yeah,
but I've got that now, so it's thundering along now. But it's took me a while to get that. But I kind of had it in my head 20 years ago, this book. But it was the book that I'd love to have been able to write. So that's coming out good now. You got the first person, the third person. It's kind of trying to combine those perspectives. It's a difficult thing to do, but I'm managing it now. And a lot of things come back. One thing I like with writing the book is, I mean, I was on it for 2.5 years, but to write about someone who's died every day and bring them back to life again, that's kind of a real pleasure from writing that. I like that with my dad, you know, when you write the scenes and it's how we were, and it kind of brings him back. That's something I really, I treasure that experience of just writing the book. Then after that, you hope it's going to sell and people are going to find it. So regardless, the second book will be a pleasure to write anyway.
Well, I wish you the very best of luck with that second book. I think, you know, if it's as good as the first one, half as good as the first one, then it'll do incredibly well. The Old Man and Me is available from all good bookshops and some bad ones as well, as we often say. But you can get it on Amazon. It is produced by Mirror Books. And you kind of get a better endorsement than that at the top. Yeah. Feels like a movie, but it's real, raw, brutal, and at times touching, from bestselling author Chris Atkins as well. So get a copy of it. I'll stick the link below. Apart from the book, what else are you doing now, Jason? Are you still working?
Interesting. We've got another podcast that this is an unusual setup. There's two ex-police officers I met at CrimeCon last year. One was ex-regional crime squad, and they do podcasts. I got speaking to one, a bit wary of him at first. He was wary of me and whatever. Really awkward. You know, your instincts are like, well, fucking get away from him. But I ended up kind of warming to him, and we worked on a podcast. It's like a four-hour podcast he's produced. And he's gone around interviewing people who knew my father, ex-CID officers, ex-wives and friends and stuff. So they put together a four-hour podcast. So I think the fourth episode goes out tomorrow, and they've interviewed his barrister. It was at the Not Guilty trial.
Yeah,
got him to do is a KC now, and he's practicing KC, and he's done an interview for a podcast, which is quite remarkable. So we've just finished that. That's going down really well. That, as you can see, you know, on the Amazon, you can see a response with the podcast. So we've done that. I'm kind of proud of that one, definitely, because like I said, a few of the people who got involved, and it's very three dimensional. It's getting away because, I mean, one thing they said about my dad was, they would like to have met him and everything, but they said they're of the view, just because he's a criminal doesn't mean he's a bad person or in any way. They'd met a lot of criminals, and some of them were nasty sods and some of them weren't. And everyone who met my dad said, no, he just wasn't like that. But the icing on the cake was meeting his barrister, and a barrister saying he was a marvellous chap. You had to meet Tony, and he was never happier than being chased by the police hounds and all this sort of stuff. He comes out with tonight. But they're very posh the way he talks, but they couldn't believe you've got a barrister, a KC no less, and he's been recorded, and he's telling what a fine fellow this Tony Spencer is, and what a good counterfeiter he was, and just because at heart his brief Charles Benson, he thought he was a great guy, one of the most intelligent criminals he'd ever met, and he just thought, no, we were friends at the end of the day. He might have been a criminal, but I admire him as a human being. So he agreed to do this interview, and it's out tomorrow.
Okay, well, get your copy of the book. We've given it a big push today. In Jason's own words, it's a story that is riddled with contradictions, and it's definitely well worth a read. Jason, thanks very much for your time, mate. Best of luck with the second book, and when you get that second one out, we will look forward to reading it and getting you on the show again. Take care, mate.
All right, thanks a lot. Cheers.
A big thanks to all our sponsors, Skips and Bins. Telephone 0800 25 45 25 3. Email inquiries at skipsandbins.com. Website skipsandbins.com. Easy contract free and pay-as-you-go waste collection. Thanks to Mr. Vicky's Sauces, which are handmade in Cumbria. Their website is mrvickys.co.uk. If you want to contact the guys, email info@mrvickys.co.uk or telephone 01768 210 102. Big thanks to New Workwear. They are an agile and dedicated workwear provider launched in 2018. For more information, go to the website, newworkwear.com. Big thanks, as always, to Media Arts for the help with the video side of things. If you want to support the channel, hit the subscribe button, become a subscriber today. Hit the thumb up under the video, which likes the video, and click share to share to your other social media. Click join if you want to become a member of the channel for as little as $1.99. Or take a one-off payment for the cult membership. You can get in via this QR code if you've got a smartphone. Or look for membership pack on the website, nufcmatters.com. What do you get for your one-off £25 payment? You get a scarf, a pen, and a cup, and a membership card, and entry into the monthly draw. Don't forget, if you want a car sticker, all you need to do is subscribe to the show and then email John at nufcmatters, and he will post you a free car sticker out. We're also available as a podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and other podcast providers. And we also support the food bank on this channel. NUFCFansFoodBank.co.uk is the virtual matchday bucket where you can make a virtual donation 365 days of the year. The new Alan Shearer raffle is underway. 150 tickets at £1 a ticket. you could win a limited edition signed Alan Shearer ball from the 260 dinner. Enter now at nufcmatters.com. We've got a few events coming up. August the 5th sees Gavin Peacock at the Tyneside Irish Centre. Tickets are £10 and you can get them now from nufcmatters.com. Our Christmas event takes place on the 7th of December at the Tyneside Irish Centre, and that's an evening with Frank Clark. Tickets are £15 and available from nufcmatters.com. Finally, Waddle, Keegan, Beardsley and friends, the Class of 84 is on at the Town Theatre and Opera House on Westgate Road in Newcastle on Thursday, January the 23rd. Tickets are now available from the Town Theatre and Opera House .co.uk or telephone 0844 2491 000. That's the box office telephone number 0844 2491 000.